Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. In her book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore, Elizabeth Rush takes readers around the country to see rising tides. Rush talks with people who have lost their homes and communities, with scientists who study what's happening, and with conservationists trying to find ways to restore wetlands. Rush's book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Rush will be in State College March 23rd when she'll give a talk at 7 p.m. at School Library to celebrate Earth Day. Elizabeth Rush, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Anne.
So your book, it's not so much one long narrative focused on one particular story, but instead it offers these snapshots of what different people are seeing happening in these low-lying areas along the coasts and different points across the country. And at the same time, it's written in this very personal way. You're the narrator taking the reader on this journey, and we go from Louisiana to Oregon, all different places. Why did you decide to approach the topic this way?
That's a great question. You know, I first became interested in rising sea levels when I was sent to write a long investigative piece actually on the India-Bangladesh border fence back in like 2010, 2011. And the thing that was most salient for me after that reporting trip was that many Bangladeshis told me, you know, the fence wasn't such a big problem, that you could bribe your way through, you could walk your way through under the cover of darkness. They said, you know, the thing that mattered most to them was that there was an arrival of saline in the aquifer and that it was leading to widespread crop failure. And if you're a journalist, you know, and you've been sent on assignment before, you know that when you're given an assignment and you find like something really interesting, tangentially related to the topic, sometimes your editor will let you explore that and sometimes they really won't. And in this case, I returned back to the United States and, you know, was given a couple hundred words about sea level rise in Bangladesh, but not much else. But I kind of returned changed. It was a moment of awakening for me that sea level rise was happening in the present tense and climate change was happening in the present tense. And yet I realized that I hadn't heard stories like that as they related to coastal communities in the United States. And that seemed to me like a pretty big omission. I figured if it was happening in Bangladesh, it must be happening in the United States. And so I sort of went out in search of places experiencing sea level rise in the present tense, and I found them really easily. So really, rising is like the snapshot of eight different coastal communities that are like reckoning with higher tides and stronger storms. And those each came into focus. Some of them were initially reporting trips I did, and I'd write about them sort of in a journalistic register. Others were places that I sought out on my own because I knew that they would ultimately make their way into this book. But I was trying to do sort of front lines reporting from the edges of the United States to talk about all the different ways that climate change is manifesting in the present tense here in our backyards.
Right. And you mentioned that you go to eight different places in different parts of the United States and kind of get this broader picture of what's happening. How did you decide where you were going to go?
So the first place I went was Louisiana. And, you know, I think when I look back on that choice and I think about that connection to Bangladesh, like it makes a lot of sense. If you look at sort of the early impacts of sea level rise in the United States, one of the biggest examples is coastal Louisiana. And that's because a lot of coastal Louisiana is and was formed by the Mississippi River Delta. And you have this historically sediment traveling down the Mississippi River and depositing itself at the river's mouth. Well, we've dammed the river that keeps some of that land replenishing sediment stuck behind each of those dams. And so we've had increased erosion and land subsidence in the Mississippi River Delta for decades. And that's then exacerbated by sea level rise. And you actually see something really similar in Bangladesh. It's not just sea level rise sort of squeezing the country from the Bay of Bengal, you also have to remember that it's the Ganges River that flows into that body of water, and that throughout the same 20th century, India placed a number of dams on the river in order to divert water for agricultural projects. So we see in some ways human intervention setting the stage for the early impacts of sea level rise to be felt more profoundly in specific places. So that's how I got to Louisiana, and then from there I started to realize that something that I sort of hadn't thought about going into this project, which was that often you would find lower income or communities of color living on this really sort of low-lying land. And so the longer I worked on the project, the more it came into focus for me that part of what I wanted to think about was, you know, what do you do about sea level rise when you live in a community that doesn't have the property taxes to fund large-scale infrastructure solutions? So that became sort of a second lens that would go on to define at least the second half of the project.
Right, because a lot of the people, the communities that are being hit the hardest by climate change and some of these rising sea levels are in poorer areas and don't have the same resources to respond to it.
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, that totally played against whatever expectations I had going into the project. I was like, okay, I'm going to write about sea level rise. I guess that means I'm going to write about, like, you know, wealthy second homeowners in beach towns. And yes, those are some of the people who are impacted by sea level rise. But I also think that it's really important to think about the ways in which certain structural vulnerabilities going into this moment of climate crisis also define, you know, who's vulnerable now and what kind of access they get to what kinds of solutions going forward. So a big takeaway for me was that resilience means really different things in different places with different people. You can have resilience in Manhattan mean, you know, landscape berms that double as skate parks and pop-up cafes, and resilience in the lower Ninth Ward might mean not getting enough money to rebuild your house because property values have long been suppressed by redlining. It might mean having to start over somewhere else. And so that became a really important sort of thread of this story the more I worked my way into it.
Right, that sometimes the people who end up in these low-lying areas, places that are prone to more flood, it's not coincidence that they're people with less resources, less money.
Absolutely not. It's like, you know, if you're looking, a lot of these places that are impacted today are areas that were zoned as wetlands, as swamplands 100 years ago. And, you know, these are parcels that were considered wet enough to be unfit for human use. And then they slowly maybe make their way into the market or become occupied in part because other people haven't historically sought them out. And that's because they're flood prone to begin with. So you get a lot of maroon communities, you know, communities started by runaway slaves, indigenous communities that are fleeing colonial violence, working class communities that can't afford to live elsewhere in our big metropolises. These are often the people who, you know, end up living atop this low-lying, flood-prone land. And to sort of assume that that's a decision that's made entirely of one's free will is to miss this larger sort of set of determining factors around who has what kind of resources and what kinds of safety where.
And you talk with a mix of experts and scientists and everyday people about all these issues and questions. And the stories from the so-called just everyday typical people, they're really striking. And I'm thinking of one in particular, Nicole Montalto in Staten Island, New York.
Yep.
And you include those in the first person. So it's really her telling her story. And in her case, it's tragic and heart-wrenching. She talks about the Hurricane Sandy and how her home becomes flooded and she actually lost her father. What was that like for you when you're going out and talking to these people and asking them to share those stories?
You know, I often think of Nicole Montalto as like the person who taught me how to write Rising. I had been writing about the community of which she was a part, Oakwood Beach, Staten Island, for about a year before she told me her story. And she told me her story at a party that was held on the two-year anniversary of her father's death to celebrate his life. And she pulled me into this guest bedroom in her aunt's house, and she said, you're writing a book, so I'm going to tell you the story of the storm that took my father's life. And she just talked for 2 hours, and I recorded the whole conversation. And for a really long time, I didn't know what to do with that story. I thought, as a writer, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can add to it to make it any more impactful than it already is. And it wasn't until a couple years later when I ran into the work of Svetlana Aleksevich, who wrote this book, Voices from Chernobyl, which really tells the story of the nuclear disaster from the perspective of the people who lived through it. When I read that book, I started to realize, like, oh, the thing that's really transformed me in terms of writing about sea level rise isn't actually the scientific reports. It's listening to these people living on the front lines and all the losses they've suffered along the way, but also the way they've pulled themselves back together, what they've made of those losses, and how they've decided to sort of become whole in the storm's aftermath. I realized with Svetlana Aleksevich that I could just include those voices in this book in the first person. I would transcribe my interviews and then sort of edit out like 95% of the language until I felt like I had like the emotional heart of a story. And then I'd send it to the interviewee and we'd work collaboratively to get it to the point where they were happy with the way the story sounded. And I felt like it was enough to hold a reader's attention. So that's how those came into the book, and I'm really glad they did. I feel like the thing that I often hear is that from readers, that those are the stories that most touch them as well.
And actually in that community in Staten Island, they actually came together and organized a buyout by the government so that the houses would actually be torn down and the water line could move in. In an interview, you said that you see that as a success story. Why do you think it worked there, and do you see that as something that can be replicated?
You know, I've thought a lot about why I think it worked there. You know, the technical term for what took place in Oakwood Beach is managed retreat. So all of these homeowners sold their homes to the state. They were paid pre-storm prices for them. And then they took that money and they bought homes elsewhere. And in the New York City case, the city didn't want to lose property taxes. So they offered a 5% closing on a 5% bonus on closing if the homeowner then took their money and bought another house in the five boroughs. And like 80% of people who participated in the buyouts in Staten Island stayed on Staten Island, which I think is also sort of part of what makes me think of that as a success story. I see it as a community coming together to fight for a sort of just storm recovery. And then, you know, they move out of the floodplain, but they don't necessarily lose their community in the process. So a lot of the folks who still live on Staten Island hang out with the same people on the weekends. They go to the same butchers, the same bakers. They shop at the same grocery stores. The thing that's really changed is their immediate proximity to flooding. And I think in many ways that really challenges some of the most significant fears we have around climate change, that it's going to force us to fundamentally become someone different or to lose a sense of our identity. And here's this experience of this community taking stock of its losses, thinking seriously about what they're willing to give up, and then maintaining part of what's most valuable to them, that sense of community, through this massive transition. When I think about, you know, places where managed retreat hasn't worked, it's often because it's proposed in a kind of top-down way, like, oh, here's the mayor or here's the governor saying we're not going to give you money to rebuild in this flood-prone place, this place that you love and that has defined you, we're going to force you to leave. I think manage your retreat as a strategy works best when it's a decision a community arrives at and not the other way around.
When you're telling these stories, we also get a little bit of a history lesson, and I'm thinking of the Swamp Land Act of 1850 and what the effects of that are that we're still feeling today. What did you find out about that?
Oh gosh, the Swamp Land Act. Now we're like in the great weeds of it, but it's really fascinating.
It was fascinating to think that, wow, something in 1850 is still affecting us.
Yeah, so you see this piece of legislation which ultimately gives states the right to sell their swampland before it was considered sort of federal property and a commons held by all. The Swamp Lands Act gives states the rights to sell the swampland to anyone that they want, as long as that person or entity promises to transform the land so that it can be quote unquote like usable. So in fact, you know, when we talk a lot, when we make those jokes about like, oh, if you believe that, I'll sell you some swampland in the Everglades, that joke came about because of the Swamp Lands Act. And it was a way for both states to have this idea of like hopefully bolstering their local economy and at the same time, ideally like gaining the ability to tax this property and gaining the money on the sale. So they saw it as sort of like a win-win. It also is part of what gives us, you know, the damming and diking and draining of the Everglades. It's part of what turns San Francisco Bay into, you know, the world's largest salt pond complex for much of the early part of the 20th century. So it led to some really profound changes in the landscape and how humans make use of it, that now with sea level rise means that we have a tremendous amount of property and infrastructure on land that maybe shouldn't have been built on in the first place.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Elizabeth Rush, whose book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction in 2019. So you say you weren't as interested in wetlands before you started working on the book. I just think that's interesting because, yeah, wetlands, it seems kind of a little bit of that like boring scientific idea, not like a sexy environmental topic. But did you find it fascinating once you started doing the research?
Absolutely. Though there was certainly a point like fairly early on where I was like, ugh. You know, why couldn't I have chosen like the Rockies or the North Cascades or, you know, a set of places or ecosystems that were fundamentally like more sublime and dramatic? And yet the deeper I sort of sunk into this topic, the more I realized that there was so much there and that they were also incredibly complex, inspiring spaces. I just had to learn how to see them in that way. And that, you know, when I went to a mountain range and felt a sense of awe, that is as much about the physical landscape as it is about sort of the traditions and the way we've been taught to think about it. And wetlands, we've been taught to think of them as sort of like the source of disease, as these like fermented, funky, squelchy swamplands, as places where monsters might hide. So I started to also realize that, you know, it's a cultural lens that brought me to a wetlands in the first place and made me want to dismiss it. And so I kind of had to unlearn some of that thinking. And I'm all for that. I'm all for sort of thinking against the grain and against your expectations. So it was a constant process of discovery, to be sure.
One of the stories you tell is about a bird encounter, and you're hiking, you're deep into the woods with a researcher in Oregon, I think it was, and you encounter this spotted owl, and you tell about how this spotted owl is staring straight at you, and it seems like this amazing kind of intense experience, but then you later find out that the bird has been accustomed to researchers, and it seems like the bird is, he's staring at you because he's hoping you're going to like pull out some food for him, and this was like a negative side effect of the researchers trying to be able to document the owls to save them. What was your reaction when you found out first, I guess, you'd had this experience in the woods with this owl, and then you found out kind of the real reason why it was staring at you.
I think my first reaction was just to laugh at myself because, you know, again, here was like a set of expectations in a way that I wanted to read a situation. I wanted to read that owl as like an inherently wild being and that it had like chosen me to communicate with. And how silly and self-centered that instinct is. Like, no, it just thought I might pull a bait mouse out of my backpack and feed it. So I think it first, like, sort of immediately made me reorient the whole story so that I wasn't, like, the protagonist of the story or the exceptional being at the heart of the story. I was using, like, the owl's exceptionalness in my own mind to sort of prove something about myself. So at first, I had to absolutely laugh at myself. And then I think my second instinct was sort of to think about the premium that the environmental movement has placed on an idea of wilderness, and that there might be something, some like wild, savage nature that's outside of human influence that in and of itself is worthy of its of preservation because precisely we haven't touched it. And, you know, I just think that in this era of the climate crisis, there's no place on this planet that is beyond our influence. And that thing that we've held up as making something worthy or not of our attention and protection might not be a useful sort of discerning factor. So it kind of cascaded into me thinking in a more critical way about some of the value systems that have been in place in the environmental movement and how climate change calls some of them into question.
You also focus on the uncertainty of what's happening, and we can try different things. And as the people you speak with in the book in California, they're trying some approaches to deal with the rising water levels, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. And I think at one point you write that we need to stop thinking that we can, quote, design our way out of this. Are you hopeful, though?
I mean, I am. People ask me often if I'm hopeful, and I think that what the future looks like is still very much up to us and to the decisions that we make today. So I sometimes think that we get into this, like, deeply apocalyptic thinking when it comes to climate change. And in some ways, that sort of tells us that the conclusion is foregone. But for every species that's living along the water's edge, for every being that's living in sort of one of these zones, a boundary marker between different ecologies, a degree, a half a degree of warming, a quarter of a degree of warming, all of that matters. And so we have to fight for each of those quarters of degrees right now. And I think that it's definitely in our power to do so. And I also think that we're seeing this wonderful, you know, rising energy around the climate justice movement. You see Fridays for the Future and Sunrise. There's been the growth of a nationwide coalition of flood survivors called Higher Ground. So I think climate change is also sort of calling us to attention and asking us to think really deeply about the world that we want to live in and the world that we want future generations to live in. I think that's an environmental awareness that wasn't really in place 20 years ago. So I think it can lead to a more just, more inhabitable future, but that still remains to be seen and is really up to us to get there.
One of the parts where you're talking about different options, you were arguing about the idea that you mentioned earlier, this managed retreat. And you mentioned the idea of a managed retreat tax, saying it could be called, among other things, the "we refuse to rearrange the chairs on the Titanic" tax, which I thought was funny. And it seemed like this idea that we need to do something real. We can't just rearrange the chairs and hope that works.
Yeah, you know, I've been just working on a new article on managed retreat. And so I was reminded, looking over how many properties the federal managed retreat program that we have in place has purchased over the past 30 years since it was implemented, and they've purchased and demolished 43,000 flood-prone homes. And on the one hand, that may sound like a lot, but on the other hand, you know, if you look forward to the projections for 2100 and how many people are going to live at regular risk of flooding, if we were to keep on at that rate, it would take us 9,000 years to purchase all the flood-prone homes that are going to be around in, you know, 80 years' time. So there's a bit of, we have to do something serious. We have to put the policies in place now in the present moment. And I think, you know, this is just one example to think about. You know, the where we're at is so fundamentally lagging behind from where we need to be. It's like a, you know, a step change, multiple step change in terms of what we need to be doing to fund adaptation and mitigation. So I think it's possible, but it takes a real commitment politically, economically, socially, emotionally, now. I think we're up for the challenge. I hope we make it happen.
And what are you doing now? What's your next project?
I'm working on a book. Last year, I went on a 2-month-long mission, scientific mission, to the calving edge of the Waits Glacier in Antarctica. It's this massive glacier that Rolling Stone has nicknamed the Doomsday Glacier because of its ability to rise sea levels significantly this century. And I went on a 2-month-long mission with the National Science Foundation to gather data on this glacier. And also during the same year that I went on that mission, my husband and I decided to try to have a child, and I'm happy to report that I'm currently pregnant. So
congratulations.
Thank you.
I saw the picture. I have to say, I think it was a photo you tweeted from that boat. It looked pretty rough seas.
It was. I mean, it was really, really, really intense, more intense than I expected. And so the book is really like this journey to Antarctica, but it's also a journey towards motherhood and towards thinking about what it means to have a kid in the present moment as the climate crisis heats up, unfolds, changes the entire shape of the world in which we live. So it's trying to sort of think about those two things alongside one another. I'm probably 8,000 words away from finishing a crappy rough draft, so we'll see.
Well, we'll stay tuned. Elizabeth Rush, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Rush, whose most recent work, Rising: Dispatches from the New American Shore, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction in 2019. Rush will be in State College March 23rd. She'll give a talk at 7 p.m. at SCLO Library as part of Earth Day. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.